Today on the 21st show, it's election day and the polls are open until 7 this evening. But rather than this year's election, we're taking a look at a political power play from more than 200 years ago when Illinois went from a territory to the 21st state. That effort is the subject of a new book called Avenues of Transformation. It's by the librarian and teacher James Edstrom, who says perhaps more than most other factors, Illinois was shaped by its land and water.
I tell my students whenever I teach my Illinois history class, I say Illinois' geography is its history. If you look at a satellite image of Illinois, you can see the outline of state except for the northern boundary and part of the eastern boundary. That really impressed me more than anything else.
I'm Brian Mackey, and we'll talk with James Edstrom for the hour today on the 21st show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is Election Day, and polls will be open across the state until 7 o'clock this evening. On tomorrow's program, we'll be talking about what happened in the voting in Illinois and across the country. But for now, we're going to take a step back and talk about the early history of our state, a different sort of politics. If you listen to our show regularly, you know we're called the 21st show because Illinois was the 21st state admitted to the Union. That was back in 1818. But the road to statehood was filled with obstacles, especially compared to our state's neighbors. As historian Jim Edstrom writes, during the eventful months of 1817 and 1818, the themes that have defined the Prairie State consistently throughout its history, patronage, race, infrastructure, and political intrigue, marked Illinois' unique transformation from territory to state. That passage is from his new book, Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. For today's show, we're going to be talking about that journey and what Jim learned as he wrote about it. James A. Edstrom teaches state and American history as a professor of library services and history at Harper College in Palatine. That's a community college in the Chicago suburbs. He earned an undergrad degree and two masters from the U of I in Urbana. He's also worked for the Urbana Free Library, the Illinois State Library, in the Illinois State Historical Library. His first book is available now from Southern Illinois University Press. Jim Edstrom, welcome to the 21st show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And listeners, we're going to structure today's conversation in three parts. We'll begin with some of the major characters from Illinois history around whom Jim structures the book. Then we'll talk about Illinois' actual path to statehood and some of the challenges and controversies that were at play. And we'll conclude by talking about how we're still living with some of the consequences of decisions that were taken two centuries ago. I should also note, in order to coordinate our schedules, we taped this conversation last week, but while our phone lines are closed, our Twitter is always open, so let us know what you thought at 21st Show, at 21st Show, or send an email to talk@21stshow.org. All right, Jim, you talk in the opening of this book about how the saga of your book started with a phone call in fall 1987. You're director of the Champaign County Historical Archives. What did that caller want to know?
Well, she wanted to know, a very straightforward question, is it true that Illinois' northern boundary was originally supposed to be at the southern tip of Lake Michigan? And you know, I was vaguely familiar at that time with Illinois' history, but not really in any depth. So I said, well, I'll look into it. And as I did more research, I realized that it was a much more complex process than merely where the northern boundary was. And at the time, I had just started working on my second master's in U.S. history. I was taking a course in Illinois history. And I turned that question into a research paper and then into my master's thesis. And, you know, I've written a few articles related to the subject. And now, 35 years later, this book has been published.
Well, so without, spoiling the book for anyone, but, you know, as here we are 35 years later, as you said, how do you answer that question?
Well, the short answer is yes, it was originally supposed to be at the southern tip of Lake Michigan. The long answer is that boundary was provided for in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, and that document was intended to govern the Northwest Territory, which included the modern states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and a few parts of Minnesota as well. And the provision was that there would be no more than five or less than three states made out of that territory. And if there were to be five states, It would be in a northern and southern tier with a boundary line drawn through the southern tip of Lake Michigan. Well, it was pretty clear that that really wasn't going to do. For one thing, both Ohio and Indiana violated that provision already. And when Illinois was waiting to become a state, it was very clear that it would be absolutely essential for there to be, for Illinois to have some water route connecting to Lake Michigan, because it was already being bandied about that a canal would be useful to create between the Illinois River and the Chicago River. And so that had everything to do with the extension of the northern boundary. But there's even more to the story on that we can explore in greater detail.
Yeah, we can get into that. So let's set the stage, because you structure your book around these three major figures from Illinois history who helped pave the road to us becoming the 21st state. Let's talk a little bit about each of them and the roles they played, beginning with Daniel Pope Cook.
Yes, Daniel Pope Cook is a very interesting figure. Most people would only recognize the name from it being memorialized in the name of Cook County. Daniel Pope Cook was originally from Kentucky. That's where he was born and raised. And as he got older, he initially migrated over to St. Genevieve, Missouri, which is right across the Mississippi River from Illinois. And then he eventually came to Kaskaskia, still a very young man. And he came under the guidance and mentorship of several important figures in early Illinois history, primarily Nathaniel Pope, the secretary of the territory, and Ninian Edwards, the governor of the territory. Nathaniel Pope provided him with education in the law. Daniel Pope Cook studied to be a lawyer under Nathaniel Pope. And in the process, he occupied a few minor territorial offices. For example, he was the enrolling clerk for the territorial legislature. That is to say, the person who makes sure that any bills that are passed by both houses are exactly the same. They're properly enrolled. He also became public auditor of the territory, and he also acted as acting secretary after Nathaniel Pope left to become Illinois' territorial delegate to Congress. But he was not really able to fulfill all of his ambitions in the territory. So after several disappointments, he decided to strike eastward, go to Washington, D.C., and with a few contacts he had, he was going to see what he might be able to bring about for himself there. Well, he visited President Monroe, President James Monroe. This is in early 1817, and Monroe gave him a diplomatic mission to travel to London to meet with John Quincy Adams and give him Adams' appointment as Secretary of State under Monroe. And that few months on the sea and in England proved to be, I think, absolutely critical for Daniel Pope Cook as he was trying to decide what his next move would be. And when he came back, he was disappointed again in his effort to be appointed as something. He tried to get the secretaryship of Alabama Territory, but that didn't pan out. So he went back to Kaskaskia, the territorial capital, and he decided that what he was going to do was to begin a campaign for the territorial legislature to petition for statehood, to send a petition to Congress to that end. And so he was really a crucial individual in making that happen and at least getting past that first hurdle.
But it's tied up with his own personal disappointments and ambitions.
Exactly right. Exactly right. But you know what? That was really emblematic of just about anybody who was an ambitious politician in the territory at that time, because patronage positions were closely controlled by just a few people, namely the governor, Ninian Edwards, with some assistance from the secretary and the territorial judges. And so there was a great deal of political conflict over issues like patronage. And in fact, Illinois territory had separated from Indiana territory originally, in part because there was a desire for people to have opportunities to get new patronage. And I think that had a lot to do with Cook's desire to do the same with getting statehood. He thought if we get a new state, that'll open up a whole host of opportunities. And that turned out to be the case, certainly for him.
Yeah, from a new state to where we are today with mosquito abatement districts and every other type of local government, we have all come out of that desire for patronage and jobs. All right,
right.
So Daniel Pope Cook is one of the people. You already mentioned Nathaniel Pope, but tell us a little bit more. He was secretary of the Illinois Territory, and he lobbied for statehood at the national level. Talk about what his role was.
Yes, that is correct. Nathaniel Pope was also from Kentucky, not too far from where Cook was from. And as I said, he mentored Daniel Pope Cook, but he too was ambitious. He became secretary of the territory when he was only 25 years old, very young man. And he acted as secretary of the territory from 1809 through 1816, at which point he ran for the position of territorial delegate to Congress. And when he went to Congress, he spent one session there with the usual kind of lobbying efforts on behalf of the territory. And then when he went back for the next session, about a month or so into that session, he was surprised to receive a petition from the territorial legislature calling upon him to enable a bill to be enacted by Congress that would start Illinois in the process of the final path to statehood. And very capable, very cagey sort of political mind, he was able to put together a draft bill within just a day or two after receiving it with the assistance of a committee that the House of Representatives had appointed, and submitted it. But then it was about another, almost a month and a half afterwards before it was finally considered by Congress. Because in the meantime, there was quite a debate in Congress about another very important issue, internal improvements. That is to say, whether Congress had the power to pay for and construct roads and canals and other similar internal improvements. And after that was finally over and he was finally able to present the bill to the Congress, he had absorbed a lot of the lessons he learned from listening to that debate and incorporated portions of that debate into the new statehood bill. And one of the results was that he moved the northern boundary of Illinois about 61 miles north because the Congress said they did not approve of internal improvements that were for interstate commerce. They did not approve it for purposes of commerce, only military and postal purposes. So he said, okay, we will remove any provisions providing for funding of internal improvements that are only within Illinois. We'll keep the ones that cover interstate commerce, internal improvements leading to other states. But in the meantime, you know what would really help us would be if we could move that northern boundary 61 miles north, because then that would give us the substantial shoreline on Lake Michigan, and it would make it a lot easier for us to build that canal that will eventually lead to an all-water route from Lake Michigan to the Gulf of Mexico. And I might add, the other direction, once the Erie Canal was created, there was also an all-water route to the Atlantic Ocean. Through the Great Lakes, then through the Erie Canal, then the Hudson River, and finally to the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Ultimately, Congress did pass it.
And why today that we don't have the biggest city in the middle part of the country, Chicago, Wisconsin. Well, let's before we need to take a break in a few minutes, but there's a third character. So we've talked about Daniel Pope Cook and Nathaniel Pope. And the third major character in your book does not, surprisingly, have Pope in his name. It's Elias Kent Kane, who was Illinois' first Secretary of State. How did he rise up in Illinois politics in the early days of its history?
Unlike most of the other major politicians in Illinois territory, he was from New York. Most of the other ones were from Kentucky or were otherwise Southerners. He came out west initially to Nashville, Tennessee, where he practiced law very briefly. Then he migrated up to Kaskaskia, and he ingratiated himself with the opposing party led by a fellow by the name of Jesse B. Thomas in opposition to Ninian Edwards' political party. And Elias Kent Kane was an extraordinarily capable lawyer. And his significance is that he was elected to the first Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1818. And he was the leading light in the convention. Really, he had more to do with how that Constitution was put together than just about anybody. And you can see several examples of that in portions of the New York Constitution that appear in the Illinois State Constitution. So very, very consequential figure.
Okay, so those are the three characters that sort of define the book. There's also this question of Illinois having multiple governing authorities over it in its early what, 50 years, the earliest part of America. Right. And at one point, I guess we were part of Virginia. I guess that'd be West
Correct.
West Virginia. So what effect did that have on Illinois' taking shape as its own place on the map?
You mean being under so many governments?
Yeah, exactly. And different political structures and so forth.
Right. Well, it made it, of course, a region of great uncertainty. There was no one consistent, reliable form of government for all those years. They started out, of course, under the French, then with the French and Indian War, went under the British. British lost it in the Revolutionary War, then Virginia took it over, and then Virginia gave it over to be formed into the Northwest Territory. And so there's a variety of governors, there was a variety of other rulers. There was all the conflicts that came with a variety of different of groups that settled in Illinois. You know, there were the French, and then Americans and English began settling there. So that made it rather chaotic. And so the people of Illinois, people of Northwest Territory overall, in fact, looked to the Northwest Ordinance as their one certainty. That was the one thing that they hoped would ensure capable and consistent governance. Basically, it made it all the more urgent for people who were politically ambitious to bring about changes in government like that, so they would have an opportunity to get patronage.
All right. Well, we're going to continue this conversation. We're speaking with Jim Edstrom, who's the author of the new book from Southern Illinois University Press called Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation on this election day with James Edstrom, who is a teacher of state and American history and a professor of library services and history at Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. And more to the point for our conversation today, he's the author of the new book called Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. We recorded this conversation last week in order to make our schedules meet, so we're not taking calls, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing us anytime. talk@21stshow.org is the address, or find us on Twitter @21stshow, @21stshow. All right, so before the break, we talked about some of the major characters around whom you structure your book, Daniel Pope Cook and Nathaniel Pope and Elias Kent Kane, and some of the different jurisdictions that Illinois lived under when it was an early state. You also mentioned some of the competing political parties, political factions. What were the major issues in and around Illinois in those decades, or the decade leading up to the drive for statehood?
Well, there were several. Certainly, there was the issue of political power, who would wield it. There was the issue of land, because there was no really coherent method of providing public land for sale for quite some time, partly because there's a great deal of land that was already held by French settlers, many of whom had fled to Missouri after Northwest Ordinance, you know, fearing that they wouldn't be able to keep their enslaved persons. And so their land titles had been bought out by a number of land speculators who saw it in their interest to, if they could, to control territorial government. So that was another issue. There was also the issue of who would be able to vote or not, because in the early days, you had to own property in order to be able to exercise your right to vote. And so at first, that ability to exert that political power was largely in the hands of people who had land and money. With time, of course, Congress changed it so that any male, white male, 21 or older, would be able to vote if they paid a territorial tax. You know, the other issue, the one that is perhaps the most consequential, was the issue of slavery. It was surprising to me to learn that there was a presence of slavery in Illinois territory. In fact, it continued in some way even after statehood took place, in spite of the fact this is the land of Lincoln.
Yeah. And let me put a pin in that, because mm-hmm. I think slavery is important enough, and I want to come back to that and give it its own
sure.
sort of time a little later. So let's now mm-hmm. talk about this push for statehood. You mentioned some of the action in Congress. What ultimately does it take to make a territory a state circa 1818?
Well, the process was outlined in the Northwest Ordinance. I already mentioned the provision that said that there would be no fewer than three, no more than five states. It also provided that a territory could petition for admission once the population reached 60,000. Although, and this is an important caveat, it could be admitted with a lesser number if it was consistent with the general interest of the Confederacy. I think that was the language in Northwest Ordinance. In other words, if it was in the good of the country as a whole. That was the essential process, and that did prove to be somewhat problematic because there was a great deal of fudging as to what Illinois' population really was. And ultimately, of course, Nathaniel Pope was able to reduce that to 40,000 to bring about the admission of the state. And he had some instructive examples right before he attempted to admit Illinois in Indiana and Mississippi. It gave him a lot of ideas for how Illinois would become a state.
You know, was it always envisioned that what we now think of as the continental United States, and maybe it's worth reminding people that, you know, the Louisiana Purchase was 1803, the lands going out to the Pacific Ocean, that didn't even come into the United States until later. It was still under the control of Mexico or maybe even Spain at
right.
this point in history. Was there always this idea that all the continental U.S. would eventually become this, you know, 48-piece puzzle or however many? Or was it contemplated that some of this land could remain just territory, or, you know, including in the language of the day, Indian territory?
That's a good question. I don't recall that there's much that's really said in the federal constitution about the statehood process, but the Northwest Ordinance clearly does outline that process. I think it certainly was envisioned, but I don't think that they thought it would happen as quickly as it did. And in fact, in the book, I talk about the fact that the older states to the east felt threatened by the admission of the newer states. They were concerned that their population would ultimately exceed that of the original 13 states, and they would get their way politically, and the older states would become much less significant. And the fact is that they were actually right about that, because the states of the West did become more consequential, without a doubt.
Yeah, definitely. You think of Texas and California and the Electoral College and everything else. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned this at one point in early American history, any given representative, I'm quoting from the book now, any given representative was far more likely to think of the admission of a new state in terms of the effect upon his own state, his own region. Did that specifically affect, or how did that specifically affect the Illinois statehood campaign?
Oh, well, I can point directly to one person in particular in Congress. There was a gentleman by the name of Rufus King. He was a senator from New York, and he was lobbied by Nathaniel Pope. There's one letter that Pope wrote that still exists to Rufus King, urging him to support Illinois statehood. And Rufus King wrote a document that I think must have been notes for a speech in Congress in which he was utterly opposed to it. He said, for a number of reasons. For one thing, he said that representation was based upon apportionment according to population, and it had to be through a federal census. In the last federal census of 1810, Illinois' population was only 12,282. Now, the statehood bill provided for conducting a census at the local level, of course. He didn't approve of that. He said that's not enough. That does not pass constitutional muster. And of course, King was a member of that first Federal Constitutional Convention of 1787. In fact, he had even seconded a proposal in that convention that essentially would have done what we were talking about a moment ago. That is to say, it would have said that no states to the West would ever have a number of representatives exceeding those of the original states. So that was a specific example. And there were other senators, other congressmen who felt the same way.
Interesting. So what was the benefit of going from being a territory to being a state? You mentioned patronage, but what does a region have to gain from statehood?
Well, at the most basic level, of course, there's the fact that they now had representation in Congress. Initially, just one representative and two senators. Up to that point, the territory had only had a delegate, but the delegate didn't have a vote and could only act as a persuader.
Kind of like Holmes Norton from Washington, D.C. for many years, and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands today. Sure.
Right. Yeah. Certainly, it gave Illinois greater leverage in enacting legislation such as the law that provided for the construction of the Illinois-Michigan Canal. In fact, that was something that was brought about by Daniel Pope Cook when he was in Congress from Illinois, as well as Elias Kent Kane, senator, and Jesse B. Thomas, who was Kane's mentor, who was also senator. And that was really consequential because it was really the starting point for Illinois to become, as it is now, the crossroads of the nation. So there was that very much so. And of course, they had the ability to vote in federal elections as well. They were able to vote for the president, which they certainly couldn't do as a territory.
And as famously people in territories today still cannot do. All right, let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with James Edstrom, who is the author of Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. It's a book about how Illinois went from being a territory to being a state and some of the political machinations that were required to make that happen, as well as some of the controversies and how a lot of the decisions taken then, we're still living with the consequences of them today. We're going to talk more about that later. What are some of the things that made Illinois' path to statehood unique?
Well, the one thing that stood out to me as I was writing the book had everything to do with the fact that Illinois is at the very western edge of the frontier. And up to the War of 1812, it wasn't absolutely a given that Illinois would stay in the United States because of the fact that there were European powers who still exerted influence in the area, namely the French, the Spanish, and the English. And that gave Illinois some leverage before the War of 1812 on issues such as being able to maintain some kind of slavery in the territory. You know, they said, if you pass legislation that will prevent slavery, you know, we've got other options. We could go to decide we're going to join with England or France, especially. So that was certainly unique. Now, after the War of 1812, that option was no longer available because those European powers essentially withdrew. And so Illinois had less leverage than, say, Indiana, or it really wasn't an issue in Indiana's case because Indiana, it was a given, more or less, that they would prohibit slavery. Illinois, it was still not a certainty. Illinois was certainly unique as far as the issue of slavery and its relationship to other powers that were in the region are concerned.
Well, and that's a great segue to that topic, because, of course, slavery is a major issue in the United States at this time. What muddied the waters around it and its legality in the Midwest, as the Northwest Territory was then known? And it's an interesting thing just for listeners. Like, we keep saying Northwest Territory. At the time, Illinois, there was no Midwest because Illinois was just the West still. Right. But what impact did slavery have on Illinois and its citizens as it started approaching statehood, especially compared to the other states that entered at the same time?
Well, of course, slavery in Illinois had existed since before Europeans settled in the area. You know, it was a practice by the Native Americans of the area, you know, it was tied in with trade. And when the French began making inroads into Illinois, they participated in that partly because it was politically to their advantage with the Native Americans. And so there was already slavery in the area. And that provided a foundation for bringing in African Americans from other regions of the United States, especially Kentucky, to do the same kind of labor that enslaved persons performed elsewhere. And in Illinois, a great deal of enslaved labor was used in the manufacture of salt. There are some very substantial salines down near Gallatin and Saline County. That's in southeastern Illinois. And they claimed that they couldn't get free labor to perform that work. And so there were several laws passed in the territory that said that you can make indentures with people who are enslaved in places like Kentucky and bring them into Illinois to perform this kind of labor. Now, an indenture, essentially, the fiction was that it was an agreement that an enslaved person would make saying, I will come to Illinois and I will perform labor for you for X number of years. And the fiction was that they were free to enter into that contract. Of course, that's not true. By definition, somebody who is enslaved doesn't have that freedom of choice. It was primarily for the benefit of the person who held them and the person who enacted the indenture. And so there was a presence, in other words, of slavery in Illinois at the time of statehood, and there were quite a few people who wanted to enable it to remain in some fashion. But of course, under the statehood bill that Pope managed to pass, it said that the new constitution of Illinois was to be, quote, not repugnant to the Northwest Ordinance. That is to say, Northwest Ordinance said there should be neither slavery nor indentured servitude in the territory. And so that muddied the waters a great deal. It made slavery a signal issue that the convention tried as best they could to finesse, to make it look as if Illinois were in compliance, but in reality, there was still very much the presence of that institution in the state.
Well, say more about that. So, and I mean, how did that convention play out? And what do those decisions say about the America of 1818, especially, you know, with the perspective we have today?
Well, first off, about half of the members of the convention were themselves slaveholders.
Wow.
Essentially, what they did was I think it was in Article 6 of the new Constitution said there shall be neither slavery nor indentured servitude. And there no indentures of the sort I mentioned before shall be honored except in the region surrounding the salt works in Gallatin County, and even in that area, not after 1825. And I think the idea was, reading through the convention journal very carefully and thinking about this, I think the idea was that they wanted to maintain some kind of a foothold for slavery in the state so that there would be an opportunity later on to transform Illinois into a slave state. Because the fact that the Northwest Territory, Northwest Ordinance said there should be neither slavery nor indentured servitude in that territory didn't mean that it could be kept out forever. It said nothing about any state formed has to forever forbid slavery from taking root. And in fact, just a few years later, there was an effort to hold a second constitutional convention. This is in the era of about 1823, 1824. There was a campaign for voters to decide whether another convention would be held. And it was very clear that if it were held, that they would make every effort to introduce slavery. Now, that proposal was turned down, thankfully, largely to the efforts of some very important anti-slavery individuals, such as Edward Coles, who was governor at the time. And Daniel Pope Cook was another one as well.
Elias Kent Kane, one of the major characters of your book, played a big role in this convention. Talk briefly about that.
Yeah, well, the fact is, one source I read said that he actually drafted the Constitution in his law office before the convention ever took place. There's no contemporary corroboration of that story, but it's very clear that he was a leading light. His name appears more frequently in the convention journal than anybody else.
I love that story because it's like you could hear, imagine it today. They didn't even read the bill. They had already had the bill written before they brought it up to the floor.
Right. Yeah. And his name appears associated with more motions than anybody else in the convention as well. And I think he was to some extent a moderating influence. He and Jesse B. Thomas were the ones who made sure that any language about slavery was deliberately vague. But he also had some rather important provisions that had their origins in the New York State Constitution that had a big effect upon Illinois for at least the next 30 years. For example, in the New York Constitution, veto power was exercised by the governor and the members of the Supreme Court as a group. And so they grafted that idea into the Illinois State Constitution with the result that that there was real chaos, because if ever there was a question as to whether a bill was legal or not, or a law was legal, well, the members of the Supreme Court had already decided they wouldn't veto the bill. So in other words, they had already approved its constitutionality. So there was a real there was a real issue with separation of powers for many years that made it very hard to run the state in a coherent way.
Sure. All right, we need to take another break. We're going to continue our conversation with James Edstrom, the author of Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. This election day, we are listening back to a conversation I recorded just last week with James Edstrom, who is the author of the new book from Southern Illinois University Press. It's called Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. It's about the path that Illinois took to statehood, literally, and some of the major issues and decisions that were taken at that time, including around the issue of slavery, which we were talking about before the break, and how we are still living with the consequences of those issues today. There's a lot of contemporary resonances in a lot of this book. So because we taped this conversation, as I said last week, we are not taking calls today, but you can always reach out to us on Twitter at 21st Show or send an email to talk@21stshow.org. You can also leave us a voicemail if you want to do that. The number is at our website. You can find it there, 21stshow.org. So let's talk bigger picture in the time we have remaining. How does Illinois' road to statehood fit into the bigger picture of early American history?
Well, one of the purposes that Nathaniel Pope had in extending the boundary of the extending the northern boundary of Illinois was to integrate Illinois more firmly into the nation as a whole. He says at one point, our avenues for navigation are to the north, the south, east, and west, by which he meant that Illinois would essentially become the crossroads of the nation. And he said that would be a means of unifying the entire nation. And you can make an argument that that turned out to be true at the time of the Civil War, because there was a substantial amount of pro-Confederate sympathies at the time of the Civil War in southern Illinois. And if Illinois' boundary had been further south, it's conceivable that Illinois might have actually cleaved to the south rather than to the north, possibly. So it was very much in line with a whole notion of the time that in order to become unified, the United States needed to be economically integrated. There was Henry Clay, who was a famous congressman from Kentucky, came up with an idea called the American system, in which he basically said that if we build this large national system of infrastructure, internal improvements, and so forth, and we build commerce between the states, that will tend to unite us together. And, you know, everybody could see that there were some very serious issues along the lines of the controversy over slavery. So I think that Illinois' geography may have been the most important factor in fitting into that larger picture that you're talking about.
You know, and we talk today about states' rights and federalism in terms of topics like voting and abortion or reproductive health. But at this time, and maybe this is worth pausing on, like the question was not really settled whether we were necessarily predominantly one country or a bunch of different states that kind of got together for certain purposes from time to time, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Say more about that divide and how Illinois might play into that.
As I said earlier, Illinois was by name a free state, but the picture was a lot muddier than that. There was some form of slavery in Illinois till 1848. And that meant that Illinois was never quite truly on one side or the other for a long time. And I think that also had a lot to do with Illinois being so closely integrated with both the North and the South, without a doubt. I think that, you know, you're talking about federal and state issues. Illinois was very much, since it was the crossroads of the nation, it was very much Illinois' advantage for there to be internal improvements that were being substantially constructed. You know, so that led, of course, to things like, as I said earlier, the Illinois-Michigan Canal. It led to the Illinois Central Railroad being constructed. And that, in turn, was connected to issues of the expansion of slavery as well. So Illinois was really at the forefront of that whole issue, really, that whole conflict that was going on.
What were some of the things that most surprised you as you were doing the research that led to this book? Over, and if listeners are just joining us, they might not have heard earlier, it was well over 30 years in the making, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, 35 years. A couple things. One, I was certainly overawed by the importance of geography. I tell my students, whenever I teach my Illinois history class, I say Illinois' geography is its history. If you look at a satellite image of Illinois, you can see the outline of state except for the northern boundary and part of the eastern boundary. That really impressed me more than anything else. And we see it every day today. You know, Illinois, I think, has the greatest amount of railway mileage in the entire country over any other state. And, you know, it still has a substantial infrastructure that's not just water anymore. It's railroads, it's airways, the information superhighway. I see a continuum from the internal improvements of that early era down to the present day. And of course, the issue of slavery was something of a surprise to me. I was, as I say, vaguely aware that there was some kind of slavery in Illinois, but I didn't realize how pervasive and intertwined it was with early history until I really began this research in earnest.
You know, throughout the book, you talk about Kaskaskia, our state's first capital, and we haven't really talked about it much in this conversation. Mm-hmm. I was really struck by some of the maps you include in the book that show mm-hmm. how really all the action and interest in the state of Illinois was really in the very southern part of it. When
that's right.
At the time of statehood. I mean, Chicago is, it's even left off of one map, the first map, published by John, is it Mellish?
John Mellish, right.
John Mellish.
1818.
1818, yeah, exactly. Because mm-hmm. he must have been working from sort of an earlier draft of the state's boundaries. But talk a little bit about Kaskaskia and how it's emblematic of the state's early history and the relationship we have to it now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Kaskaskia was, at that time, it was really the cultural and commercial center of the Mississippi Valley. And the fact is that region of Illinois had been a major trading center for centuries, long before European settlers ever came to this country.
Do we need to tell listeners that Kaskaskia is this area sort of at the confluence of the Mississippi and what is called now the Kaskaskia River?
Correct. That's exactly right.
It's very far southern Illinois. Yeah.
Yes. It's not far from Carbondale and Chester, Illinois, and somewhat south of St. Louis as well. But that whole area has incredibly fertile soil, and has everything to do, of course, with being along the banks of the Mississippi, which, you know, moves that soil and makes it that much more productive. And so Kaskaskia was really the center of it all. The problem, however, was, as you said, it was looking at the confluence of the Kaskaskia and Mississippi rivers, and there was really only a very narrow strip of land that connected Kaskaskia with the rest of the state of Illinois. There was a lot of flooding that took place on a regular basis. And it finally separated from Illinois in more or less the main state in 1881. There was a terrific flood. And there have been a lot of floods down that area even since then. The most recent severe one was, I think, in 1993. And the fact is, though, that it was very clear at the time of statehood that Kaskaskia was not going to be a permanent going concern. There was a belief that the state capital needed to really be further to the north. And so eventually, within 2 years, I think, after statehood, the capital was moved to Vandalia. Kaskaskia continued to be something of importance for a little while after that, but its population dwindled. I think nowadays the population may be no more than about 10 people or so. There are still people there. And still a very interesting place to visit. There's there's a couple of artifacts located on Kaskaskia Islands, they call it now. There's something called the Liberty Bell of the West, which was the original bell housing that was housed in the cathedral on Kaskaskia. And there is the most recent version of the Kaskaskia Cathedral that I think still has the original altar that was built in the original cathedral on Kaskaskia Island. We're talking in the late 17th, early 18th century, something like that. And it's important place to visit because it is really the ancestor of everything. You know, it's our physical ancestor, but also our political, economic, cultural ancestor in every way. Very important place. And it's a shame that more people don't know about it.
pretty inaccessible today, though. You write about your own difficulties trying to visit
right.
it. Yeah.
Right. That road, there's one road that leads. You have to go through Missouri in order to get there, and it gets flooded from time to time. And, you know, one of the last times I visited it, there was so much water that I had to stop, and I couldn't go any further. And that was in the midsummer, I think. But it is well worth visiting, without a doubt, if only to place yourself imaginatively in that point of reference, to be able to envision what it must have been like 200 odd years ago.
Well, all right. So in the time we have remaining, let's bring our conversation full circle. And let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Jim Edstrom, who's the author of Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. What are some of those decisions that were made as Illinois was on its way to becoming a state that are still affecting us today?
Well, certainly, I'm sorry to say, the ongoing presence of slavery is some form of it in Illinois for long afterwards. Slavery was not fully banned in Illinois until 1848, when a new constitution was created. At the same time, I'll note for you that the new constitution said it required, mind you, that the state legislature would have to pass laws that would prevent the immigration of African Americans to Illinois. And they actually did that, of course, but that was only building upon what already existed. It's since, I think, 1819, there had been a series of what were called black codes in place that placed severe restrictions on the lives of African-Americans. They weren't able to testify in court. They had to carry certificates of freedom. They were severely punished if they assisted in somebody escaping. They were certainly subject to being kidnapped and sent south on what was called the Reverse Underground Railroad. And in fact, those black codes were not repealed until 1865, around the time that Illinois was the first state to approve the 13th Amendment that banned slavery. And of course, you don't just get over that kind of situation overnight. You know, I will say, you know, it's gratifying to think that over time, there have been efforts to overcome that. You know, certainly, you know, Edward Coles, with his effort to ban slavery in Illinois in the early days, prevent it from becoming a slave state. The repeal of the Black Code, largely overseen by a man by the name of John Jones, an African-American tailor, who spent years getting it repealed by 1865. But there were still a lot of other things going on that were very much in place as far as slavery is concerned. Now, if you want to talk about other things, let's talk about infrastructure. I already have talked at great length about how Illinois has become the crossroads of the nation. And I've talked about the fact that there was a real debate going on over whether it was a good idea or whether Congress had the power to enact internal improvements. And we still see that kind of conflict even today. I think within the last year, of course, we had that debate over repairing the nation's bridges and roads and railroads. There was even talk about expanding the notion of infrastructure to include things like elder care and daycare and that sort of thing. And you'll notice that there were a lot of people who thought that that was not properly the power of the federal government to enact. And they were concerned that some areas of the nation would get more attention than others would. And that is certainly an echo of what was going on in Congress at the time about internal improvements at the time of statehood. So those are two things, the legacy of slavery and the legacy of internal improvements.
Well, that and a lot more are contained in this book, which again is called Avenues of Transformation, Illinois' Path from Territory to State. The author is James A. Edstrom, who is also a professor of library services and history at Harper College in Palatine, Illinois. Jim Edstrom, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your work with us, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's been a real delight.
And that's all the time we have for our program today. One more reminder, this is Election Day. Polls are going to be open across Illinois until 7 this evening. And be sure to join us again tomorrow when we'll talk about what happened in the voting in Illinois and across the country. We've got a great panel of political reporters and analysts lined up. That includes Amanda Vinicky of WTTW in Chicago, Rick Pearson of the Tribune, and recently retired University of Illinois Chicago political science professor Chris Mooney. That's all tomorrow on The 21st Show. And a reminder, you can find our podcast and listen to our past segments and interviews at our website, 21stshow.org. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Just search for The 21st, V21ST. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Anaya Jones and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to vote, and we'll talk with you again tomorrow.